Welcome to the Diplomat Podcast. I'm Yong Kwon, columnist for the Korea's blog. August 18th marked the five-year anniversary of the passing of Kim Dae-jung, 8th president of South Korea and a Nobel laureate. He had dedicated most of his life to opposing successive authoritarian regimes, contributing to the movement that forced South Korea's authoritarian Fifth Republic to concede popular elections in 1987. Reflecting on Kim Dae-jung's achievements, one must also assess how far the liberal movement has come since South Korea's democratization, and particularly after Kim left office in 2003. Overall, the performance of the liberal parties in the 2000s have been somewhat lacking. They have lost two successive presidential elections and have not won a majority in the National Assembly since the 2008 legislative elections. Prone to fracturing and infighting, the current liberal coalition party, the New Politics Alliance for Democracy, were soundly defeated in the most recent by-election in July, giving up 11 out of 15 constituencies to the Conservative Centenary Party, including one in the liberal home turf of South Jeolla province. This is quite a remarkable failure, given Conservative President Park Geun-hye's low approval ratings since the Sewol ferry disaster. It appears the liberal movement in South Korea has reached its nadir. Here to speak more on this issue is Stephen Denny, PhD student at the University of Toronto and managing editor of the research site SinoNK. Good to have you here today, Stephen.
Thank you for having me.
So, would you contribute the recent electoral defeat by the NPAD to successful conservative politics or liberal incompetence?
It would be hard to say that the conservatives have been successfully politicking. They've avoided internal implosion. So I would say that it's mainly liberal incompetence. Although incompetence is a bit hard. I think a lot of, as I hope we can get into throughout this discussion, a lot of the problems that face the Liberal Party aren't new things. It's problems they've been facing for the better part of two decades.
When you say conservative implosion, what do you mean by that? Like party like fracturing into two? Like are there examples of this happening previously in South Korean politics?
Oh, absolutely. That's precisely what I mean. The conservatives have won, particularly in the latest by-election, which I think we'll talk about a bit more in a little bit, avoided sort of overt internal infighting or party fracturing. That's precisely what they did. Examples in the past are most recently in 2004, during the administration of Noh Moo-hyun, the ruling parties fractured into two. Between the
Uri Party, right?
The Millennium Democratic Party split. From there was a fracture party called the Uri Party, Uridang, and that consisted of Noh Moo-hyun supporters who thought that many within the party were too lukewarm, were providing too lukewarm support, and they wanted to shuffle things up. The consequence of this ultimately was Noh Moo-hyun's impeachment, and he was effectively discharged from power for some time before being reinstated. So that's a bit extreme, and I don't think the ruling party was ever at that point, but they did avoid sort of an open public fight, like an internal battle. Mm. So they, by avoiding that, by maintaining basically party discipline, they were able to pull out a win. Now, there are a lot of other reasons for that, which I hope we can get into in a moment. But, yes, they maintained sort of internal consistency, right? There was no party split.
Right. And for a little bit, though, it felt like there was a risk of that when we had, within the Conservative Party, a faction that supported President Park Geun-hye and a faction that supported a more distant relationship between the party and the Blue House, right?
Right.
During the leadership election of the Centenary Party.
Correct. So Kim Moo-sung, who is known to be somewhat of a cavalier, who's the alleged leader of the anti-Park faction, although there's some debate as to whether or not this is an anti-Park faction or just some other faction within the ruling party. He was elected to the chairmanship position, and he defeated Soo Chung-won, who was considered to be the pro-Park faction leader. Now, if there was sort of some internal fighting going on, you would think that such a result may, the consequence of this, of the defeat to the pro-Park faction leader may result in some sort of fracturing, similar to what happened during Noh Moo-hyun's administration, but we didn't see that happen.
Right. I mean, it almost seems as though the victory of the faction that supported a more of a independent relationship of the party and the president actually helped the Centenary Party during the by-election, because president's low approval rating didn't necessarily sink the party, right? Because
right.
a closer association between the party and the president would have probably hurt them more in the polls.
Perhaps.
Right.
Now, or we could just we might just chalk it up to the fact that the Liberal Party, the MPAD, is incapable of communicating a consistent message to voters.
Right. And I mean, so what is their main message, would you say?
The MPAD, so the new Politics Alliance Democracy, is about struggle. So they've, in a lot of ways, institutionalized the Minjoo movement. Mm. It's a bit of a bold claim, but if you look at the rhetoric coming out of the progressive
base. Just quickly, Minjoo movement refers to the pro-democracy movement during the 1970s and 80s, right? Against the authoritarian regimes.
Right. So this call for struggle was met with a lot of support. People sympathize or empathize with this message then. But now it's a bit outdated. Mm-hmm. So when you have calls for struggle against what is perceived to be a quasi-authoritarian or perhaps just an authoritarian government, it's met with almost a deafening silence. Because people are concerned about the economy. They're concerned with whether or not they're going to be making 10% more or 10% less than they did the year before.
Right.
And a lot of people recognize, correctly, that they do not exist under an authoritarian regime any longer. Yet, the Progressive Party has seemingly been unable to escape the same old message. So they've in effect, institutionalized struggle.
Right.
So this is what the party is named for. It's a stretch to say that that this is a consolidated or institutionalized party, but if we could admit that, it would be an institutionalization of an old message.
Right. I mean, it seems like it's slightly anticlimactic to apply the same kind of rhetoric that the liberal movement used against the dictatorship when they're talking about, say, the Sewol ferry disaster, right? About public safety. It seems a little exaggerated.
Yes.
Right. Does this mean that the liberal movement, I mean, you're suggesting that the liberal movement is slightly out of touch with, like, average South Koreans, but if so, this is quite surprising, because on the surface, there are still so many restrictions in South Korean society, like on freedom of speech. I mean, we had the whole dispute over whether or not the government was having too much of an influence over the Korean broadcasting service. We have issues with gender equality, issues over labor rights, immigration policies, and others. I mean, these issues suggest that the center-left social views should have, like, it should attract voters. I mean, why is this not happening in South Korea?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm reminded of the title to a blog entry written by Joshua Stanton at One Free Korea. And he follows this issue quite well. And I think he's got his finger on the pulse of sort of political developments within South Korea. And the title of this blog post was, I have it written here, "Post-Sunshine South Korea is Sober, Pragmatic, and Grouchy."
Grouchy.
And he emphasized how this is true even for South Korea's youngest, the youngest generation, the youngest voting cohort. These are the people who are most typically supportive of progressive policies, liberal parties. But if you look at recent polling data and interviews conducted with these people, you find that South Korean youth are very much so-called young realists. And realist has been a term that's used by my friends at the Asan Institute, who have their fingers on South Korean developments, political, social, and otherwise, through their public opinion polls. So they're generating a wealth of data. And they find that South Korean youth are basically pro-US, that they have ambivalent views towards China. They do not care too much for unification because it's so expensive. And they're increasingly unlikely to be supportive of pro-engagement policies. Policies, a la Kim Dae-jung and Moon Jae-in,
right? The sunshine
successful
policies.
The sunshine policies. They're not too excited by the notion that these would be reinstated or reinstituted. Mm-hmm. But they're not. I mean, they're not going to be. But they're not very supportive of engagement. They see North Korea as just another country, as an enemy, as someone who puts in jeopardy their high standards of living or their personal security. So of course they don't support engagement in the way that engagement was conducted during the Sunshine Era.
Right.
So in this new post-Sunshine Era, these sorts of people are, as Joshua says, sober, pragmatic, Mm-hmm. Now, it's more than that, because you also have to take into consideration the fact that even young people vote with their pocketbooks a bit. And it just means that they're sort of, they're conscious of the, you know, the state of the economy. They're worried about the sort of jobs they're going to get after they graduate, or if they've already graduated, what sort of jobs they want to get, right? Mm-hmm. Now, add that to the mix, and what you have is, like, a very conservative electorate. Because I think those people from the so-called 386 generation, they are going to be probably the most likely to support liberal policies. No. But their children, the youngest generation, has grown up in an entirely different South Korea. They don't know the same sort of things that their parents have. They didn't struggle against an authoritarian government during their college years. Mm. You know, they studied for tests. They drank beer with their friends, and they sipped lattes at cafes.
Right, right.
So they have a very different orientation, and the consequence has been, contrary to perhaps expectations, a sort of conservative effect.
Right.
Overall, you have a conservative electorate.
Right, I mean, the younger generation do still vote largely. There is still a large support from the younger generation towards the liberal parties, but perhaps this is suggesting that it's less than what it should be in, say, other post-industrial societies?
Yeah, that's one perspective. I think it is right to point out that it doesn't necessarily mean that these people in their 20s are not voting for the liberal candidates. Although these people are much more likely to not vote for them.
Right.
But to address the question you just asked, it does. It reflects something about South Korea. That's not unique in the sense that it's South Korean, but it's unique in the sense that South Korea has entered its post-industrial stage, the post-industrial era. But the values that you see amongst South Koreans are different from the sort of values that developed in other post-industrial societies when they were entering the same period that South Korea is. Mm. And the reason for this is, I would suggest, that South Koreans do not enjoy the same sort of physical and economic security that a lot of other nations did when they first entered the post-industrial period, the countries of Western Europe. Mm. Of course, there was always the Red Menace, the threat from the USSR, and the possibility that World War III could break out. But that was sort of a distant possibility. And you had, it was sort of offset by developments in welfare state policies that made these people feel secure. And when you add that with the sustained economic growth, what it produces what political scientist Ronald Engelhardt calls post-materialist values. Mm-hmm. And these are what he calls a syndrome of political values. They include everything from high levels of interpersonal trust, an increased tolerance for outgroups. Mm-hmm. These people who show exhibit post-materialist values are much more likely to favor policies that promote individualism and self-expression over things like political and economic stability.
Right, right.
They moved on from the period of modernity and industrialization into a period wherein innovation is key, creativity is key. And these sound like lofty, sometimes meaningless words, but it is sort of linked to a particular period in a country's development where these sort of values become more important.
Right.
Now, it would be wrong to suggest that none of these sort of values are flourishing within South Korea right now. It's not that. It's just that they're not all flourishing. So there's been sort of a partial transition. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that South Korea faces a lot of problems. And these problems are systemic, but they're manifesting themselves in society. And they're really starting to show themselves. And if you open up the Financial Times, you read the Global Post, and you see the journalists who are in South Korea writing about abject poverty amongst South Korea's elderly population.
Right, right.
Or the extremely high suicide rates for kids and elderly. The low birth rate of extremely low levels of happiness.
Right.
And so these are the consequences of South Korea's, the particular trajectory that South Korea developed went through.
Right. Speaking of developmental states, in our previous podcast, you spoke about Dr. Slater and Wong's research on strategic democratization by authoritarian regimes to retain power. One of the key points made in their research is that This process requires the former regime to establish a clear party platform that channels their past legitimacy into the new democratic era. As a developmental state, South Korea's then ruling Democratic Justice Party chose economic development as its rallying call in 1987. How much of the old regime's strategic orientation on economic development do you see conservatives channeling today?
Right. Another good question. Before I answer that, I want to talk a little bit about sort of a great irony that I think sometimes people forget. But the irony itself explains a lot. So I'll touch on that. So the authoritarian government, which was being struggled against by the opposition,
like Kim Dae-jung.
By people like Kim Dae-jung, was ultimately given what they were struggling for by those they were struggling against. That was democracy. So this is like what Wong and Slater are pointing out is kind of a great irony. But it's a very strategic move by an authoritarian ruling party. So this works in authoritarian regimes wherein those in the position of power is a ruling party who can make the transition to democracy. And under certain conditions, those in power, such as in South Korea, are thought to have made this sort of this strategic decision to concede democracy because they thought the party that was in power might actually be able to win in open competitive elections. And in fact, that's what happened.
Right.
So it went from an authoritarian party, then conceded democracy, went to bat against the opposition party and won. Now, the only reason they won is because the opposition was split.
Hmm. Well, they knew that they were going to be split, right? They knew that there was going to be internal strife once the
right.
Democrats had the chance to gain the presidency.
Right, yes. Otherwise, you can't imagine that they would have went forward with conceding democracy if it would have meant the removal from power.
Hmm.
So it was split between Kim Dae-jung and Kim Yong-sam. They were both sort of opposition leaders, and they split the ticket, and Noteu went on to win. Now, the question of how much they're channeling today, or how much we can attribute their current success to the channeling of past accomplishments in economic development, is difficult to say. I don't know for sure how much or how little is actually used. But it is, I think, fair to say that the legacy that the ruling party wants people to remember is the legacy of economic transformation. Of course, they're not gonna play up the oppression and torture and other depressing things. They're gonna talk about how the party that they once were was responsible for developing Korea's economy, is responsible for Korea's magnificent rags to riches story.
Right.
But it's not enough to simply rely on the historical legacy of economic development. I mean, of course, people want the economy to continue to develop. They don't want it to. They don't want the economy to crash. They don't want economic conditions to worsen.
Right, and as you mentioned earlier, young people want jobs.
Yes, I mean this is natural. This is all very very obvious. But the thing to emphasize here is that we've reached sort of the point in sort of Korea's history, the post-industrial South Korea, and the people in post-industrial societies, they want more than just economic development. They want a good life.
Mm.
They want more than just economic and physical security. They want to be freed from, in the South Korean context, the burdens of a welfare society. So in times past, lifetime employment, when this was a thing, and cost of living was more manageable, things were cheaper, and Korea was still developing, people were basically able to rely on the family. And, I mean, that's what the welfare society is about. It's different from the welfare state because people rely on the family as the institution which will sustain them from beginning to end.
Right, right.
We've reached a period wherein that's no longer possible, and the strains that have been placed on the welfare society are really starting to show themselves.
Right, demographically as well, right?
Before. Yes. So you have low birth rates, high suicide rates, low levels of happiness, high levels of depression, this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so naturally, you would expect political parties, so the crucial linchpin in the democratic process, the central key intermediary organization between civil society and the government, to respond. And they are responding. If you look at the rhetoric that was used by Park Geun-hye in her campaign, it was stuff about improving the welfare state. It was stuff about making Koreans happy, about implementing policies that will cultivate innovation and creativity. These are the sort of words that she's using because she knows where Korea is at. Now, has that actually been done? No, it hasn't. And in fact, the Park Geun-hye administration has done basically nothing.
Right.
So there is opportunity for the Liberal Party to reap political gains from Park Geun-hye administration's failures, which was why it was kind of so surprising that they did so poorly in the July 30th by-elections, because the Park Geun-hye administration hadn't done anything. In effect, had been riddled by scandals. Mm-hmm. Yet they still lost. They lost handedly. It wasn't even close.
Right.
And it was like as if the ruling party was given a second mandate. Mm-hmm. So now, but if anything, though, this puts even more pressure on the administration to perform, or at least in theory, it does.
Right.
So they have the number of seats in parliament to push through policies that they want, despite lower approval ratings for Park Geun-hye's administration. The State Unity Party has the highest level of support amongst all parties, hands down, by far. It's not even close. Mm. The Liberal Party, in fact, polls the approval ratings for the Liberal Party is lower than the number of people who don't identify with the party in a recent Korea Gallup poll. Mm. So people have the option to not choose a party at all. More people say they do not support a party at all than do support the Liberal Party.
Right.
So they have the opportunity. Will they take advantage of it to actually put words to policy? Is yet to be seen.
Right. From the American perspective, isn't the long-term retention of power by the conservative a good thing? I mean, we've seen in the past that liberals, not just in Korea, but in other places around the world, they tend to be against free trade agreements, and they tend to be against closer military cooperation in the United States. So would you suggest that the long-term retention of the conservatives of power by the conservatives in South Korea is a good thing for U.S.-South Korea relations going forward into the future?
Perhaps. It is well known that Noh Moo-hyun's administration,
which was liberal,
was very different from others. Yes, Noh Moo-hyun's administration was very liberal, and they were very critical of the status quo, of the U.S.-ROK alliance, of South Korea's North Korea policy, which Noh Moo-hyun attributed to, you know, pressure by the U.S. government, by the U.S. position. And he wanted to shake things up. But that sort of period wherein he was doing this sort of stuff notwithstanding, it seems as if it's not going to matter which administration is actually in power, or which party is in power. Mm. So if you look at two things, free trade agreements, the U.S. supported neoliberal world, as loaded as a phrase that it is, it's basically what we have. And then military cooperation between the U.S. and South Korea. I don't think that it's going to matter which party is in power. You're going to have a government that's committed to the globalized economy. I mean, look at it. The forces of globalization have a very powerful effect on smaller states like South Korea. Mm. They have very powerful effects on their economic policies and the domestic politics. Taking into consideration South Korea's export-oriented economy, that's dominated by a handful of conglomerates that are export-oriented, that are exporting to make money, equals a South Korea that's very outwardly oriented, is very sensitive to the international global. And I mean, in fact, South Korea is the only country to have free trade agreements with the two largest economies in the world, the European Union and the United States. And in fact, the FTA that was concluded with the United States was originally negotiated under Noh Moo-hyun's administration. So that's sort of the economy perspective. Now, if you're going to take like a military perspective and military cooperation, it would seem as if it's going to stay constant if the party that's in power is concerned with popular sentiment.
Right.
As I was discussing earlier, even the youngest generations and the youngest voting cohorts in South Korea are basically supportive of the U.S.-ROK alliance. They do not support radically different North Korea policies. They certainly do not support Sunshine Era policies. Mm. So the notion that a liberal government would come to power and then do things like Noh Moo-hyun did at the beginning of his administration seems very unlikely. So to me, in my opinion, it's not going to matter if you have a conservative government or a liberal government. You're going to have a continued strong U.S.-ROK alliance, and you're definitely going to have a South Korean government that's committed to the neoliberal global order.
Right. So despite the fact that we see periodic explosions of discontent by the South Korean public on issues like beef imports from the United States, these things are not necessarily going to spill over into policymaking at large.
Maybe not, but the gusts of popular feeling, as they're sometimes described, are very volatile. So things could change.
Right, right. Well, I think we had a very engaging and informative conversation on the state of not just the Liberal Party, like we started off with, but South Korea as a whole and where it's heading into the future. I think you've underscored very key problems in South Korea that will be very important for us to keep observing into the future. Thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me on again.
Thank you.